Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how were cities born and how have they affected culture, economies, politics, and societies? What has changed in the 21st century, especially after the pandemic? Which cities are the best for quality of life and how can cities offer a sustainable and fulfilling future? Doug Becker interviews Ian Golden, author of The Age of the City. And first, the U.S. House of Representatives is in crisis with no speaker in the House, which means they cannot do the country's business. What led to this crisis? Is there anything in history that can guide the U.S. through this chaos? What does this all mean for the country at such a crucial time? Why has it come to this? And what's the way forward? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The United States currently does not have a speaker for its House of Representatives. And what this means is that Congress cannot conduct business. This seems fairly unprecedented as a development throughout American history, American politics. But on today's show, we're going to explore the roots of this political crisis and ask exactly how historically unprecedented is this when a party that has the majority in the House of Representatives can't seem to select a speaker. And our guest is Jeremy Suri. He's a professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, and holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs. He's the author of numerous books, but most recently and most significantly is the book Civil War by Other Means. Jeremy, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm always happy to be with you, Doug.
Always great. Always feels like, you know, bringing on an old friend when we get a chance to talk with you. So, first question. Republicans can't seem to settle on a speaker. How unprecedented is this?
This is actually quite unprecedented. We use that adjective too often these days, but in this case, it's apt. Generally, parties that win a majority in the House develop, despite their differences, a clear consensus on someone to lead the party for the very reason that in order to get anything done on their agenda as the majority party, they need to have a speaker. Now, different parties will set up different rules for how much power that speaker has. So we could have a discussion about powerful and less powerful speakers, speakers who controlled the Congress and speakers who didn't. But it's really hard to find any example in our history where a party that has a majority, as the Republican Party does, seems unable and unwilling to select someone to actually allow it to pursue its own agenda in the Congress that it has a majority in.
And ultimately, I guess I'm tempted to say, is this variable based on the fact that the Republicans, that there's kind of a wide chasm within the Republican Party, you know, how conservative versus less conservative moderates? But that doesn't seem to be the reason what's going on here, right?
I think that's not unprecedented. So there have been many eras in which, for instance, the Democratic Party of the 1950s had Minnesota and Wisconsin liberals, and then it had Southern neo-Confederate Jim Crow members, and they still were able to work together and find a speaker who would bring order to the House. And they did that actually for decade upon decade. The challenge today is that the Republican Party is splitting apart before our eyes, and there is an insurgency. I think that's what it has to be called, an insurgency of a small number of Republicans on the far right who, whether you like them or not, are willing to burn everything down unless they get their way. And because the Republican majority is a small majority in the House, they have 221 seats, and you need 217 for a majority with 433 right now. So because they have a margin of 4 or 5 votes, a small insurgency of 10 people or 8 people can hold the entire caucus hostage. In the past, members of a far right or far left wing within either party have been bought off and have seen it in their own interest to go along. What we have are a group of terrorists in the Republican Party who have said it's their way or nothing. That's how they took down Kevin McCarthy, the prior speaker, and they're standing in the way of any compromise right now. And they're explicitly obvious about that. I hope your listeners recognize I'm not characterizing them. I'm using their own words. They themselves are saying they will not compromise. They, as 8 or 10, believe they have the right to dictate what the entire Congress does. And that's what's preventing any speaker from being chosen.
No, absolutely. And by the way, that use of the term terrorist reminds me, that was John Boehner's description of some of those insurgents, one of which has been a candidate for speaker, the candidate Jim Jordan called him a legislative terrorist, which then raises the question that if you have an insurgency that's going to hold the entire Republican caucus hostage in what those of us who teach negotiation talk about maximizing versus satisfying positions, you must get everything versus what you're willing to accept. Why not just name one of those individuals as the speaker? And then presumptively, they'll take the rest on board with them, and then you create a governing coalition.
Well, I think it's a variety of reasons why that's not a viable solution for the majority of Republicans. First of all, those on the far right, the moderates in the party don't trust them. They don't believe that they will actually try to serve the whole party because they see them as terrorists. That's what other Republicans are saying about the far right. Second, those on the far right have no legislative experience also. Jim Jordan, who you mentioned before, has been in the House more than a decade, and he has not passed a single piece of legislation. To be speaker takes a lot of skill. You have to understand the rules. You have to manage. It's sort of like saying, you know, taking someone who's one of our, you know, students and putting them in the role of running a university. They might have good ideas, but there are certain skills and knowledge of how the institution works that these oppositionists, these extremists, don't have. And then there's a third reason, which I think is the most important, which is many of the less extreme Republicans, those who were elected, for example, in New York, they're in districts that Biden won. They're in districts that actually are pretty moderate, or maybe 50-50 or 51-49 Democrat-Republican. They're at 18 districts like that in the country. And if they have an extremist running the caucus who acts like an extremist, as they expect these extremists will, they're then unelectable in their own districts. So for their own self-preservation, in fact, they've already been harmed. Some of them have had to make a vote and sometimes have voted for an extremist figure. That will be held against them when they run for re-election. And I think this is a pretty safe prediction. Some of them will not get re-elected. They were already in tough races. This will be used against them. So how on earth can they support an extreme right speaker when they've got to go home and campaign as moderates?
Let me lay out a theory that I have. I mean, there's multiple theories that we can get into: the gerrymandered districts, the lack of competitive districts, you know, certainly can play a role with all of this. But I'm inclined to follow the money. And so therefore, my theory about why, you know, this is happening and how this could potentially become a feature of American politics has been the weakening of the political parties. That it used to be that the way in which you could guarantee your support is you had to play ball with the party because the party was responsible for funding a good part of your campaign. Nowadays, because the parties don't have that control, you're able to find other sources of campaign finance that you actually benefit by being not a team player. And in particular, because one of my favorite lines is the most dangerous place to be in Washington is between an elected official and a camera, because then they can go to the camera and actually make appeals for money. So there's my theory. What do you think?
I agree 100%. And in fact, we have a natural experiment. You're probably writing some peer-reviewed articles on this right now. We have a natural experiment before our eyes. So many of these candidates on the extreme right, the ones who voted, I think there are 8 of them, to deny McCarthy the continued speakership role, they have been raising more money than they did before as a consequence of that. Matt Gaetz being the poster child of this. That would not have been the case 30 years ago. 30 years ago, if you did what these extreme members of the party did in either party, then the party leadership would say, no money for you in your next election, and you would lose. But now the fundraising doesn't go through the party. It's the paradox of our time, Doug, that it's a partisan time, but parties, as you said, have less power. And you say that again, it's a partisan time, but the parties have less power. The partisanship is not coming from the party apparatus. It's actually coming from individual entrepreneurs within the party who are exploiting extreme views through the internet, through fundraising, as you say, and therefore have an incentive. For Matt Gaetz, a compromise candidate is bad for him. He can't continue to raise money off it.
And the irony of all of this is the weakening of the political parties came from a drive for a call for greater democratization. Because for years, Democratic theorists say democracy is between the parties, but the parties get to choose their own candidates. But there was this pushback progressives within the Democratic Party, conservatives within the Republican Party, saying, well, we shouldn't have party leadership choosing our candidates. The candidates really need to be much more, you know, much more independent. So is democracy, or at least this perception of democracy, a democratizing of fundraising, a weakening of the political parties, is that creating this crisis of democracy?
Well, part of what's creating this crisis is what you said. It is that the parties that formerly had structures to filter candidates, they're not filtering candidates. The primaries are a version of that, right? We all recognize that the Republican establishment would not like to see Donald Trump do so well in the primaries, but they can't really how people vote in the primaries, and he has his own method of getting people out to vote for him. But I think this is where we also have to bring in what you referred to earlier very well, Doug, which is gerrymandering. We have sorted ourselves. Some of it is self-sorting by where we choose to live. But a lot of it is how we've drawn our representative districts with such precision using computer technology that now we've created mostly homogeneous districts. And that means that there's no incentive for any new kind of person to try to run for office. It's just more of the same. And that also withdraws or limits the power of the party because the outcome is already determined. The candidate doesn't need the party as much as they might have in the past. It's interesting, again, back to where we were before, the Republicans who have been most opposed to the extremes are the ones from the few districts that are less gerrymandered. They're the ones who cannot tolerate this. And so that's where the parties have been unable to step in because the districts are self-sorted. There's very little choice. The party might not want Marjorie Taylor Greene from her district, but the only person who can win that district because of the nature of the people in that district is someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene.
And a reminder that when we think of more extreme or certainly rejectionist types of candidates, rejectionist meaning, you know, carve their own pathway and certainly no discipline from the party. I believe this is still true. I remember reading this a few months ago, that the second most successful fundraiser in the Republican Party, second only behind Donald Trump, was Marjorie Taylor Greene.
That's right.
And then you mentioned Matt Gaetz, et cetera. And one of the big issues with Matt Gaetz is it's fundraising is part of it, but it's also just visibility, that he is now one of the most recognized Republicans in the entire country, precisely because he was responsible for killing Kevin McCarthy's speakership.
Right.
So what do we do about that?
Well, so I think, again, we're running a natural experiment here. It's sort of ideal for social scientists. Maybe you guys are responsible for all this, trying to create a laboratory of what's happening here. There's a lot of small money, which is to say, you know, tens and twenties of dollars that candidates like Matt Gaetz and others raise online. By the way, Obama did that too. But what's still significant are the big donors. There still are some very, very, very wealthy people out there. And for the last 10 years, they have followed the trend. So when they see someone like a Matt Gaetz who's collecting money from lots of small donors, the big donors jump on because they think then they can use him. This happened with Trump also when he ran. It does appear right now, at least, that a lot of the big donors in the Republican Party are now starting to sit on the sideline. They're starting to sit on the sideline because they actually want stuff done. This was McCarthy's whole argument for not shutting down the government, that it doesn't help us, even the extremes who think it helps us. It doesn't, because a lot of the money still wants government to get things done. People want their Social Security checks. Businesses want roads to be functioning and things of that sort. So we'll see. We could be at the origin point of a backlash against this trend. We could be at the end of the moment when extreme entrepreneurs can dominate the party, and we might see things flip back in a different direction. I will say that is happening in the Democratic Party. As you know so well, Doug, 10 years ago, if we were sitting here and you asked me, okay, which party is least disciplined, which party has the most trouble getting itself together, we would have said hands down the Democratic Party, right? But that's not the case now, because the Democratic Party has organized itself around small donations, but also around some big donations from some big progressive donors. And it works through Hakeem Jeffries in the House, before that Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden, and really uses that organized fundraising to help its candidates across the board. And that's what it, at most moments, keeps the extreme members of the Democratic Party in line. Maybe that will happen with the Republican Party. Now, it's really up to the big donors. They have to say they're not going to continue to give to the extreme candidates anymore, even though they're on Fox News.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker, and we're discussing the crisis in the House of Representatives, the inability of Republicans to be able to elect a speaker, with Jeremy Suri of the University of Texas at Austin. And so you mentioned about the backlash. One thing that certainly is contributing to the sense that this is, in fact, a crisis, Matt Gaetz said, really, what have we not done last week? Maybe we would have passed a couple of ceremonial pieces of legislation. But I think a couple of things have happened, have developed that certainly have changed this narrative. The first was the trigger for why McCarthy lost the speakership, which was that he struck a deal to fund the government. And so, you know, the recognition that refusing to fund the government creates a crisis. But then, of course, you know, looking to foreign policy, the attack in Israel and, you know, as well as the drying up of funding in Ukraine are pointing to at least two areas where this really is a crisis that Congress needs to be able to act. Is that the way out of this, that in essence you're playing politics, but by playing politics, you've created real political peril and the crisis means get your act together and select somebody?
Yes, I do think so. I think what brings this to an end is the pressure from these policy areas where even the most extreme Republicans, or maybe they still think this way, but the vast majority of Republicans recognize they cannot be seen as being ineffectual and, quite frankly, out to lunch, that they have to go back to work. And Israel puts this front and center. If there is an issue that unites Americans across party, right, it is the support of Israel. There are a lot of people who criticize that within our society, but it is a distinct minority voice among our political leadership in both parties. Support for Israel is as ironclad as any issue is. Neither party wants to be seen as being weak on supporting Israel after it's been attacked. If the Republicans continue to be unable to reopen the House for business, they are unable to provide additional assistance to Israel. President Biden is putting pressure on them for that because he wants assistance for Israel, but also because he wants them to come back to work. And that's a very hard one. I mentioned these Republicans from New York, a number of whom were elected at the same time Joe Biden was elected. They are all in districts that are like 80 to 90% supportive of Israel and want to see Congress pass aid yesterday for Israel. So if they're unable to get back to work, they might as well not run for office. In fact, they might as well just decide to retire at the moment. So I think the way this ends is when enough of those Republicans either persuade the party as a whole to ignore the extremists, or they form a bipartisan deal with the Democratic Party. And there have been times in Congress and particularly in state legislatures where we've had bipartisan speakers. That might still be a Republican rather than a Democrat, but it would be a Republican with rules that provide both parties access to the floor. The key power the speaker has is determining which legislation gets voted on. There are a lot of things the Democrats support that actually, if they were brought up for a vote, Republicans would vote for too, but the speaker keeps those things off the floor. Democrats want those items to come onto the floor. You could see an agreement coming together around that. It's probably just a question of when, not if.
Yeah, that actually was the transition, you know, to sort of the next area I wanted to address. Because one of the great mental gymnastics, political mental gymnastics, is blaming the Democrats for this crisis. That because 90% of the votes against McCarthy came from Democrats. And of course, those of us who followed politics, you don't have to be a historian like you, you just have to have followed politics for the last 4 or 5 years, is to recognize the political parties just don't vote for candidates from the other political party for the speaker. But maybe the point out of all of this is that if the Republicans can't resolve this, the Democrats are going to have to resolve it for them. Obviously, they weren't going to vote for McCarthy because McCarthy literally offered them nothing for that. But what's the likelihood or the pathway where Republicans offer, you know, it's going to be a Republican candidate. They've got the majority, but one, I mean, you highlighted some questions about legislation where the Democrats do step in and say, well, we have to get things done. What sorts of things, you know, might the Democrats demand? And could it create a new model for the speaker that's much more bipartisan than it has been?
I think so. And I think the Democrats are already offering this. Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader in the House, has repeatedly said that they want a bipartisan solution, and they are willing to vote even for a Republican candidate so long as the rules are changed to give Republicans a chance and give Democrats a chance in particular, right? So I think we're in that space. The Democrats are not going to fix this for the Republicans because it's clear to everyone. You can say whatever you want about the Democratic Party. The Republicans have a majority. As a majority, it is up to them to choose a speaker and govern the House. And they have failed to do that. The Democrats had exactly the same numbers under Nancy Pelosi and were able to do that. So the blaming the Democrats on this, I don't think that's a talking point that persuades no one. It's a rationalization. When you have the majority, you are expected to use the majority to run the House. And for the last 240 years or so, that has been what has happened. And as you said, for most of the last 240 years, the opposition party doesn't vote for your speaker. Nancy Pelosi had zero votes from Republicans, and every time she ran for speaker. So it's not a good argument. It's not a workable argument. It's not a persuasive argument, even on Fox News, for the Republicans to try to blame the Democrats. There have been many cases where the parties have agreed on rules that will allow both parties to see some value in a particular person being speaker and both parties to be happy with that. The Democrats have come forward and said that they're not even asking, as far as I know, for committee chairs and things like that, which is usually what the speaker does, hand out committee chairs. They've simply asked for the right to bring legislation that they want to the floor for a vote, which seems so eminently reasonable. If the Republicans won't agree to that, the Democrats are not going to agree to anything more for very obvious political reasons, Doug. This is a very good position for the Democrats to run on. We've offered bipartisanship. They've rejected it. One of the statements that came out from actually Steve Scalise, who was for a time also a candidate and seen as a more moderate candidate for speaker, was, "We will never make a deal with the Democrats." Is that really what the Republicans want to run on? Maybe in Marjorie Taylor Greene's district, but do they want to run in the center of the country on that? So all the political incentives are for the Democrats to offer bipartisanship and to wait. And it's going to take the Republicans developing the will to make a compromise to get moving forward again.
So the key question I was thinking about with all of this inability to name a speaker does seem to be fairly unique to this Republican caucus, derived at least in part. Read a piece that was talking about how the roots of this is actually in 1994, when Newt Gingrich was elected speaker, in part because it was about that the House should be governing less. The whole idea that government needs to be smaller under Reagan. I can't remember which one. You probably remember exactly which one of these activists said government should be so small you should be able to drown it in a bathtub. And those arguments. And so, is this partially ideological, where you've got a political party that is so dedicated to a government doing less that what's more less than nothing? And so, therefore, yeah. What's the ideologically, this is actually consistent with some of the positions Republicans have carved out over the course of the last, say, 25 years.
Perhaps, but I think that's more a rationalization. Their argument for smaller government has always been to reduce bureaucracy, not to reduce what Congress does. Look at what the Republicans have walked themselves into. They criticize Biden for not doing enough on the border. But you can't do anything on the border if Congress isn't open. You can't pass any legislation. They criticize Biden for apparently breaking the law and they want to do all these impeachment investigations, et cetera. You can't do those if you're closed, right? So they have an agenda which actually emphasizes doing things, maybe not the bureaucracy doing things. I think your point is right. They're anti-bureaucracy, but they're not anti-Congress. They actually want Congress to hold the president more accountable. They want Congress to combat the president, and they can't combat the president, as they've promised their constituents, when they're not even showing up for work. I mean, that's the irony of this. This is contributing to more of the imperial presidency, something we've talked about and you've written about also, Doug. I've written about it. I mean, over time, the presidency has become too powerful. I say that as someone who sometimes thinks there are legitimate roles for the president. Nonetheless, we look to the president to make war because Congress doesn't get involved enough. We look to the president to make immigration decisions because Congress hasn't passed legislation, et cetera, et cetera. The best way to make the presidency even more powerful is when you don't even show up and the president's the only actor.
So we're recording this on Thursday morning, Thursday afternoon, actually, and there is currently no speaker. Do you have any predictions? You're the historian. I can ask the historian for predictions. We social scientists hate those. As to how this all gets resolved?
Well, I think this gets resolved in the end when a number of moderate and less extreme Republicans say enough is enough, we are going to make a bipartisan deal with the Democrats. Maybe that's about converting the interim speaker, McHenry, into a longer term speaker with some powers, or it's about creating another speaker with promises to the Democrats for some of the things they want. Here's what I can firmly predict. When we get a new speaker, it will be with a lot of Democratic votes. It might even be with more Democratic votes than Republican votes.
And that would actually be rather transformative for the speaker. We would probably, at that point, I would imagine, look back and say, this truly was something different and actually maybe sets the speaker position on a little bit of a different trajectory than certainly the last, shall we say, 15, 20 years, right?
As you said before, we could have a different model. We could have a model that changes here. We could, if it works, well, who knows? It creates a precedent for something else.
Although I guess the flip side is, since the Democrats don't have this problem, that when the Democrats win a majority again, whether it's 24, 26, 28, whatever, would they also accept this much more bipartisan model? Or if they can manage their own caucus, what would be the motivation to make concessions to the Republicans?
No, and this can be a warning against getting into this difficulty ever again, certainly.
We've been discussing the ongoing political crisis with the Republicans' inability to name a Speaker of the House and potential paths forward to try to open up Congress and allow Congress to get its work done. Our guest today has been Jeremy Suri. He's a professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, and he holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs. He's the author of numerous books and also a host of a podcast called This is Democracy, and the most recently published book, Civil War by Other Means. Jeremy, thank you very much for sharing your insights and joining us today.
Doug, I enjoyed the conversation as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
How were cities born, and how have they affected culture, economies, politics, and societies? What has changed in the 21st century?
Stay tuned.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How were cities born, and how have they affected culture, economies, politics, and societies? What has changed in the 21st century, especially after the pandemic? Which cities are the best for quality of life, and how can cities offer a sustainable and fulfilling future? Doug Becker interviews Ian Golden, author of The Age of the City.
I'm Doug Becker. Cities have played a significant role. They played a role in economic development, in the development of culture, development of politics, of literature, and of the nation itself. What this role has been historically is a field that actually a number of scholars have addressed over the course of the last number of decades. But a new book raises this question in light of some of the challenges cities face in the 21st century, and some of those challenges, including pandemics like the COVID pandemic, of climate change, the environmental impacts, and certainly some of the political and social cleavages that cities and rural areas, development of areas around cities have played in recent history. One of the authors is our guest. Ian Golden is a professor of globalization and development at the University of Oxford, and his books include Rescue from Global Crisis to a Better World and Terra Incognita, 100 Maps to Survive the Next 100 Years. And then most importantly, a new publication from Bloomberry Publishers, Age of the City, Why Our Future Will Be Won or Lost Together. Ian Golden, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure.
The book starts by talking about the history of the city, the role that the city has played, is this in development, in political development, social development. How important have these cities been historically?
Cities have been absolutely central to human development. We certainly wouldn't be what we are. We wouldn't have made the achievements we have, the breakthroughs we have, without the development of this capability of living together in rather small geographical areas. And of course, it depends on and has grown historically due to the advent of technologies, technology that allowed the refrigeration of food, the piping of water through aqueducts, for example. Elevators allowed cities to become much higher. Railroads, then later cars, allowing people to move over much greater distances. But from the earliest days of cities like 30, 40,000 years ago, this coming together redefined the way that human society organized. And it was, of course, based on the ability of agriculture to create a surplus. You can't have cities if everyone's got to be working in the countryside all the time. You need some people to be able to provide more than they need in the countryside to feed the cities. And it was the agrarian revolutions that really allowed cities to develop. We know historically that they've been the source of immense power. Imperial cities, of course, are very famous, the center of empires where people were mobilized, armies were mobilized, but also technologies were developed in the Ottoman empires, the Greek empires, later in the Roman empires as well. And of course, the Renaissance, which was really the breakthrough for Europe, came out of a small city, Florence. And it's no accident. It wouldn't have come out of the countryside. It's this coming together of people, the allowing of specialization, people focusing on particular activities, which is what cities permit. It's the close proximity. So you can communicate very effectively, you can trade very effectively, you can share knowledge and effectively whether it's ideas or whether it's commerce. And of course, many cities then developed at crossroads, bringing transport together and later shipping. Once the Age of Discovery was launched in the 1500s, across the Atlantic, across the Indian Ocean, and elsewhere. So cities are the crossroads of ideas, of trade, and have been absolutely central. And what we discover in the book is that that remains the case. In fact, cities are becoming ever more important.
And one of the things that's striking is you think about the drive to urbanization in the 20th and 21st centuries. And one of those arguments is that the delivery of services are easier through cities, government services, social services, et cetera. But historically, life in cities was particularly difficult life, wasn't it? People weren't necessarily moving to cities because the life was easier there than on the countryside.
No. And as you know, Blake wrote in his poetry about the damnation of cities. Marx, Karl Marx, wrote about the evil of industry in cities. Got great books on Chicago, which talk about how bad it was. Dickens and all the Dickens stories tell you about how awful they were. Not just extraordinary levels of pollution and poverty and disease that spread in these cities, but exploitation of children, workhouses, right, and everything else. So cities weren't necessarily nice places, but they were the places where there were jobs. And they were the places where there was this potential to escape from your past. If you were living in a rural area, you really were locked in to a cycle which was very hierarchical, very determined by the past. And cities, and they continue to do this, give people an ability to basically change their lives, to become someone different, to escape their family, the pressures of the past, etc. And we see that as being more and more important as people want to exercise their rights, whether it's about their gender, whether it's about their views, their taste in music, their taste in food, whatever. Cities have always provided that diversity, that cosmopolitan spread. So cities were, particularly in the after the Industrial Revolution, nasty places to be. And actually, life expectancy, if you moved to a city, went down for people because they were so polluted. And then, of course, there were the diseases spread by water and bad sewage and so on. But that really has transformed this in the 20th century. So now, for example, life expectancy is higher in cities than it is in the countryside, in most places, in most states in the U.S., etc. And one's access, etc., one's ability to do things is very much different. And it's that progress that's leading now about 60% of the world's population, well over 4.5 billion people are living in cities. And virtually all the growth is in cities, economically and population-wise.
Now, when we think of cities, and you address this rather remarkably historically in the book, you think of inequality, that cities represent perhaps even more so than rural areas, deep divisions between the haves and the have-nots. I was struck by, reminded by your quote from Plato in his description of inequality within cities. Is there something about city life that produces greater chasms of inequality than on the countryside? And is there something kind of endemic within cities that helps to produce this inequality?
I think what cities produce is extraordinary potential for wealth and for high incomes. It's not that they make people poorer necessarily, because you always have the option of not moving to the city if you can find a better income elsewhere. But cities produce extraordinary wealth. Businesses tend to be located in cities, and a lot of cutting-edge professions over time are in the cities. And because the skills are short, and because of various other reasons, these people now in banking, for example, in law, in IT, in other sectors, are paid incredibly high incomes. And so the gulf widens. That is a very, very significant factor. So inequality within cities is growing. And of course, inequality between dynamic cities and the rest is also growing. And that's, I'm sure we'll come to it, but that's also growing political tensions, because some cities have been much better than others at staying on the frontier of economic growth. So it's that tension that is leading to growing credit. It doesn't have to be like that. Part of this is due to unaffordable housing. So what happens on housing policy, the collapse of social housing in, for example, Britain, the privatization, basically, of public housing after Thatcher, Reagan revolution has greatly exacerbated that. Housing is very important. The cost of services, whether it's daycare or childcare or schooling or health, really matter. And of course, the distribution of wages, whether they're decent jobs for people who don't have the skills that are earning very high incomes.
And I think with me being in Los Angeles, immediately when you think of inequality questions, of course, the unhoused community is so significant here as well. Mm-hmm. It seems like cities, much more so than certainly suburbs and rural areas, have this unhoused crisis. I mean, is it fair to say that it's just the cost of living in the cities, the cost of housing, et cetera, is why we're seeing unhoused populations in urban areas that we just don't typically see outside of urban areas?
The unaffordability of housing is a massive issue. The restriction on public housing is a massive issue. Of course, people come to the cities who wouldn't really be able to get by in rural areas because they couldn't get the services. There's no prospect of a job, etc. So if life would be better for people in rural areas, you'd expect them to stay in rural areas. Mm-hmm. So as terrible as it is for these people that come to cities, that's where they are, because mm-hmm. it's better probably than the alternatives. Now, a lot of people are evicted from homes. High interest rates now are going to compound this problem in the US and in Europe. And so how cities cope with this is absolutely central to many things. And what we see, for example, in parts of Los Angeles, parts of San Francisco, but you see it in my hometown, Oxford, people sleeping on the streets. How one stops that and how one overcomes it is really absolutely central to the livability of cities.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker, and we are discussing a new book, Age of the City, Why Our Future Will Be Won or Lost Together, with one of its authors, Ian Golden, who's a professor of globalization and development at the University of Oxford. So I'd like to turn our attention now to more contemporary issues. But first, still a little bit historically, at the end of the Second World War, there was this move away from cities and this drive to suburban life, that kind of deurbanization and the suburbanization of politics. And of course, being in Los Angeles, again, the word that describes LA probably better than any is sprawl. There's just, you know, so much of the city around. It seems there's been more of a trend to move back to the cities. What was it about the cities themselves and the drive for urbanization that seemed to undercut this drive towards suburbanization, where the cities shrunk in size, but the populations around the cities grew, to now the cities themselves are growing larger again?
This suburban sprawl, which you see in so many places, not just in the US, but around the world, driven by technologies, by cars mainly, and the ability to move, but also public railroad systems and other systems which allowed this to happen, the underground system in London, for example, in New York, greatly exacerbated this. It's partly that inner cities were not very pleasant. They were often ghettos. People didn't want to live. They wanted to get away from them to clean areas. They wanted more space, houses and gardens, etc. And it was partly, I think, which is going to prove to be historically misplaced, the idea of segregating very tightly where you work and where you live. So the development of central business districts that have no life, you know, in the evening or weekend, which are already dead. Because you're going elsewhere, and then you have suburban malls where you spend your weekend or whatever for entertainment and leisure activities. So that model, which was, I think, is now really under question. It's partly that inner cities have been gentrified. They've become places that were industrial, that were warehouses, that were poverty-stricken, have become the go-to places for the younger generation, particularly, but also for creative people in many cities. And that's because they value this proximity, the walkability, the history that's around them, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That's pushed a lot of poorer people out further into the suburbs. So there's sort of this reversal in a way. It's also that the average age of marriage has got a lot older. So people are earning income now before they get married and have kids. There's a much longer gap before that. And that's changed the nature of who lives where, when. So that's had an impact. Of course, many people are choosing not to have kids as well. And just valuing their own lifestyles independent of children. And that takes away the pressure of getting to a home with a garden near good schools, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That reversal has been accelerated in some respects, but not in others, by the pandemic. So, I mean, the pandemic was a massive shock to cities. Remote work led to the fleeing from many cities of people that could, professionals particularly, that could work remotely. Essential workers had to still be there. And now the question is, what happens next? And we in the sort of hybrid mode where people are saying come to the office 2 or 3 days a week. That is destroying the ecosystem of cities. So the barbers, the baristas, the dry cleaners, all of that around these offices is suffering terribly. Small businesses, as are the offices themselves, we see very high vacancy rates, particularly for lower grade offices, and big questions about the survivability of public transport systems that depend on mass commuting in order to be viable. So this is a perfect storm for cities. And we see in San Francisco, we see in some other cities, that if cities start losing their income, then they start being providing lower services. And that leads to this downward spiral. You don't have as effective police. You don't have as effective social care. You can't house as many homeless people. And you get into a very dangerous spiral. So it also has consequences, I think, for companies. I'm not a great fan of remote work because I think that jobs are apprenticeships and people need to be together. And what drove the growth of cities, which is the sparking off each other and the hive that cities are, gets undermined if you have a fully remote work. Not hybrid is fine. So this is the dynamic that's happening, and what we talk about in Age of the City is where this is going.
One of the themes, certainly, when you highlighted this question about remote work, hybrid work, et cetera, was that economically we may not need to gather, you know, to do our jobs, but that cities as arenas of community. That's, you had highlighted the younger generation, the millennial and Gen Z generation, wanting to live in cities. And I think of that as being driven at least in part by, you know, social and cultural. I mean, the events that are taking place. They want to go to concerts and shows and plays, et cetera. And the same with respect to work, this sense of community within work. Now, that, of course, being disrupted by the fact that we have just lived through this pandemic, driven by, you know, it's a communicable disease where interaction and community was something you wanted to try to avoid. You know, the term is social distancing. How do those two tensions sort of navigate one another? The need, the desire, the want for community with a fear that too much community, certainly in the case of COVID, ended up producing some pretty poor results for people.
Well, pandemics are the biggest test that cities have always faced. I mean, they were, you know, this has always been the problem that cities have become the incubators of pandemics because of this close proximity of people, but also the super spreaders because of their connectivity. In the old days, through shipping or through railroads, now through the fact that cities are all hyper-connected through airline networks. So this is how, despite that, mortality rates in cities, if you look at the statistics, are actually not worse in cities than in rural areas. And in many small towns, they were much worse. And that's because they also have the knowledge, the health workers, the facilities, the ability to get your food without, you know, through Deliveroo or through a service like that, which you can't have in the countryside. You've got to go to the store, etc. So the evidence doesn't suggest that being in a city is more dangerous for people. Obviously, this is highly differentiated by income. If you can't isolate, if you share a small place with seven other people and you have to go to work in public transport and you have a terrible health service nearby, your chances were much worse. But on aggregate, cities haven't done worse. And I think going forward, where this leads is, firstly, we've seen in the, you know, in the bounce back from the pandemic, eagerly people are embracing, and you see this in the vibrancy of what's happening in many cities. We are social creatures. We want to engage with others. The pandemic also taught us something really fundamental, which is we care about others. People were making sacrifices all the time on behalf of others. Many people died on behalf of others, as they do in wars. And you get the sense of what cities offer you is that meaning that comes from social interaction. Of course, you can be desperately lonely in a city, but you can also be desperately lonely in the countryside. And the chances of finding like-minded people and escaping your loneliness are greater in the city because of this like-mindedness, because of the network, because your neighbors will know if you haven't emerged after 2 days or something in a way that they weren't in the countryside. So the cities, this is a tension, and it's an inevitable tension between proximity and contagion. But it's one, I believe, that can be managed and will be managed going forward. And where we really want to get to is a place, and we've got a chapter devoted to this in Age of the City, where cities are the circuit breakers of pandemics, not the super spreaders.
The last topic I want to raise here, I'm a political scientist, and I've seen in so many elections around the world, not just in the global north, but, you know, global south, certainly these have played out, that there's a distinct political tension between cities and suburban and rural areas. I always like to point out that we don't exactly have red states and blue states in the U.S. We have red areas and blue areas. And even in states that are, you know, overwhelmingly more conservative, more red, the cities themselves tend to be bluer. And in places like California, California is blue in part because it's so urbanized. And so, first of all, what do you think is behind some of this political tension between cities and rural and suburban areas? And it seems to suggest potentially deep political divides between the cities and the areas around.
There was a flurry of books in the early phases of globalization, like The World is Flat and The Death of Distance and things like that, that suggested that opportunity would be spread everywhere. And what we're seeing instead is the world becoming much spikier. That place matters more than ever, and where you are has a bigger impact on your life expectancy, on your income, etc., than in the past. And that's increasingly, it's within cities, but it's between the successful cities and the rest. The old shape of cities was determined largely by natural resources, near a mine, near a coal mine, near a port, near a cotton ginnery, whatever it was, and that's where the work was. That's why Detroit. But now we're in the knowledge economy. And now we basically, most of the economy is in services and in knowledge, increasingly in knowledge services or professional services at the high income end. And that means people can work wherever they want to, basically. People are much more able to decide where to live and which cities they want to live in, particularly young people. So there's a paradox because actually people are much less mobile than in the past. So in the US, people are under half as mobile now as they were 40 years ago in terms of moving between states. And when you ask people why, and this is to answer your political question, why don't you move from these towns in the Midwest where there's very high unemployment, very little prospect, to say Silicon Valley or the East Coast, where you get very high salaries and high employment levels? And the answer, we can't afford to move. We can't afford a home. We're in negative equity on our home. We can't get our kids into school. We can't get our parents into elderly care. There's no public transport. Commuting over the distance from where we can afford is too expensive and takes too long. And we've done, and there's an example in Age of the City, of the calculation of whether it's worthwhile moving from Detroit to New York or to Palo Alto. And for many people, it's not, because the overall cost of the move is just too great. Mm-hmm. When you take all these factors into account. Now, these people are stuck in the past. They're locked into places which don't have prospects. The jobs are not going to come to these places in the future. And they're angry. And the financial crisis doubled that anger, because this was something that came out of New York, out of the big banks, out of the metropolitan elite, and no one went to jail. And it destroyed a lot of people's lives. And so people are very disillusioned with the ability of Washington or New York or Silicon Valley to help them, to care about them. And what some politicians said added to that anger about these people not being respected. And I think it's that divide in the sense that we can't escape where we are and you don't understand and you're not helping us in the places that we are, that's leading to this growing political divide. The sense of the two countries, they're those that are, happen to be in thriving cities, and they're those that are left behind places. Mm-hmm. And the people in thriving cities are running the show, and they don't care about us. And I think the politicians that can appeal to those people, whether it's in the US, or whether it's in Britain, in the north of Britain, and the whole Brexit fantasy, or whether it's in Germany with the AfD, or in France with Marie Le Pen, or wherever, the people that can say, I care about you left behind people, I'm going to help you, are the ones that are touching a real chord. And it's geographical, it's spatial. And it's also, of course, related to things like age and profession. The young people with well-paid jobs tend to be in the big metropolitan cities. And that's going to augmented artificial intelligence is going to compound all of this, because it's going to increase the income differentials, not reduce them.
And with that, the title of the book is Age of the City: Why Our Future Will Be Won or Lost Together. One of the authors is Ian Golden. He's professor of globalization and development at the University of Oxford. He's been an economic advisor to President Nelson Mandela and the founding director of the Oxford Martin School, the author of Rescue: From Global Crisis to a Better World, and Terra Incognita, 100 Maps to Survive the Next 100 Years. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thanks, Doug. It's been a real pleasure.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.